into it. Hello, I'm Simon Mercier. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to music, to film, television, theatre, in fact, just about anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And we've got a rather unusual edition of Crave this week. It's an international, it's a transcontinental, transoceanic episode.
Oh.
I know, we're pulling the adjectives out, aren't we? Not only because of our live comedy, theatre, and even an evening with a political heavyweight, but also, Simon, you're about as far away from me as it's actually possible to get and stay on the same planet.
I think that is absolutely correct. Yes, I am talking to you, Steve, from the northern Norwegian city of Tromsø. Kilometres. Tromsø. I think I'm saying it correctly.
I would have no way of questioning you.
It's T-R-O-M-S-O, but the final O has got a little dash mark through it. Anyway.
Like they made a mistake and they're crossing it out, yeah?
Yeah. I'm 300 kilometres north of the Arctic Circle. Now, I'm in a hotel room. That's why I'm not surrounded by polar bears and ice and reindeer. I'm here because it's a fascinating place to come to. My partner Sharon works at AUT in Auckland. She's here for academic work, and basically, Steve, I've tagged along.
Why not? So you're in the Lapland studio of Crave.
That's right. We're branching. You're setting up international offices all over the globe.
Why not?
Scandinavian office is in good heart. Yes.
Excellent. So are we doing this week's episode in silly Scandinavian accents then?
Oh my goodness! I mean, I've made some lovely friends here, and I would not dare mimic their accent. I wouldn't do a good job.
Actually, in my experience, those guys probably speak English better than we do.
Oh, their English is superb.
I know. Yes. It puts us to shame. They should be doing this instead of us, shouldn't they, really, quite frankly?
I know. That's right. Well, I might should do a couple of interviews with them, and I'll incorporate it in the next episode of Brave.
Good man.
I have to say, I've only just got here, so I don't have a lot of Norwegian popular culture to reflect for you this week. But, you know, next time I will.
Good enough. We shall look forward to it.
Yes,
absolutely. In the meantime, we are staying international. We're going to be talking about Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Not a name you expect to hear in an entertainment podcast, but you know she's doing an international tour. She's not doing too much in the way of new material. It's mostly a greatest hits tour, really. To be fair,
yes.
But wait till you hear what she does for an encore.
Yeah. Yep. So we've got her. We've got some young British comics who've been in Auckland for the comedy festival. What else, Steve? There's another New Zealand film we're going to be talking about.
Yes.
A comedy as well, as it happens, called The Breaker Uppers. And you've also been to catch a show from a writer-performer you've seen before. This is Penny Ashton, right?
This is Penny Ashton, who's got her latest one-woman show, Olive Copperbottom.
What a wonderful name.
It's a wonderful show.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. I look forward to hearing about that. Now, just Steve, just before we get into our menu, there is one topic I could just very quickly touch on, which has a definite European flavour to reflect where I'm talking to you from. This is Sunday morning in Europe.
Yes.
And it's the morning after the big annual Eurovision Song Contest.
Oh, yes.
Is that something that you've ever been a fan of, or have you tended to ridicule it?
I think fan is the wrong word. I mean, I grew up in England in the 80s when the Eurovision Song Contest was, quite frankly, I mean, it was cheesier than a Frenchman's armpit. It really was. It was a great big bucket of camembert, and it was impossible not to watch it, ironically.
Yes.
That was
yes.
the thing.
Well, Yeah, well, I think, talking to my Norwegian friends here, I think it's still extremely popular here. People, you know, host Eurovision parties to watch the finals, but I suspect the strong sense of irony is still lays heavy across this competition, across the continent of Europe.
I have a sneaking suspicion you might well be right there, yes.
Yeah. But it's a phenomenon, though. It's still going, and people watch it. They turn out to watch it. So it's interesting.
Absolutely.
Anyway. Yeah, but let's turn to some Kiwi culture, shall we?
I think we should.
We have both seen it's a new film. It's a local comedy. It's called The Breaker Uppers. Now, if you are listening to us and you happen to have caught my review on our website, cravepodcast.com, you'll know I've enjoyed it. Steve, what about you?
It's not bad, is it? I mean,
Oh, God, there's a ringing endorsement if ever I heard one.
It's good, but...
Okay. I could hear a but in there somewhere.
I saw it on a Saturday afternoon at my local cinema here in Pukekohe, and it occurred to me that it was a lovely way of spending a Saturday afternoon. It didn't really stick with me as much as it should, and I'm not quite, and I don't know why, because there's so much about it to absolutely love. We've got Madeline Sammy and Jackie Van Beek. They wrote it, they directed it, and they starred in it, and they play two old friends, Jen and Mel, who run an agency called the Breaker Uppers, and it's their job to dump couples on behalf of a disgruntled member of said couple who hasn't quite got the nerve to do it themselves, and so they will dress up as police women and tell someone that her husband is missing, presumed dead, or they will be the other woman for the afternoon to give the impression that he's cheating on her, for example. And
yes, that's right.
And so the idea is that they're doing this as a public service, and that in itself, as I've heard observed elsewhere, could quite easily be an extended sketch on a TV sketch show. However, what they do try and do is invest it with a little bit more humanity and heart than that, and they try and explore what happens in particular when one dumping doesn't quite go as planned, and when the friendship between the two kind of goes a little bit astray, doesn't it? A bit awry.
So I agree. So we get a bit of backstory, don't we, about the long running friendship of these two and how they've been intertwined in the past with their relationships with men. So that's one strand, as you say. And then, as you say, there's the other victim of a breakup, who's played by a character called Anna in the film, who's played by Celia Pacola, I think that's how you say her name.
It sounds about right.
Like a case, it's a case too far, isn't it?
Yes.
It shows how one of the women, Mel, who's played by Madeline Sami, is a bit more empathetic than the other partner, Jen, that's the Van Beek, who's more businesslike and matter of fact. So that becomes a bit of a friction in the story. I hear what you're saying about maybe it not quite all gelling as it should have. I thought that the work of the two main characters was good. There's a lot more invested in their characters, so they've got a bigger well to draw on, don't they, in terms of fleshing out who they are and where they're going.
Yeah.
And I thought there's some other characters around them who are funny, but, I don't know what you thought. I have to say they're funny but not that well developed, perhaps might be a way of putting it. Jen's mother is played by Rima Te Wiata, who's been a well-established comic actress in New Zealand for many years and a very good actress, and she plays a particular sort of upper-class, snooty mother. We don't know why she's upper-class and snooty and where her character comes from, and that slightly worried me a little bit. And another well-accomplished and successful young actor, James Rolleston, plays a young teenager who strikes up a relationship with Madeline Sami's character. And what do you think, Steve? I thought these were funny characters, but a little bit on the cliched end of the spectrum.
Very slightly, in particular, that the girlfriend that James Rolleston Jordan wants to dump, Sipa, played by Anna Scottney, is I mean, she's a very well drawn sketch character, but somehow not quite enough to make a full film out of it. But I don't think it mattered too much, because I thought that the characters at the very heart of the film were sufficiently well drawn and sufficiently well acted that they could just about carry what was a fairly thin conceit otherwise.
I'll go along with that. One of the things that really struck me and I enjoyed about this film was the story takes you on a little journey whereby we are meeting characters who have had dabbled in different, you know, talk about their sexuality now, and I don't want to give too much away, but you know, a character might be bisexual or not, they may have a relationship with a younger person. There are certain social, conservative social views that will be challenged by this film, and I think the way they've written it is to deal with this in quite a sort of a matter of fact way, as if to say it's no big deal that one of our, you know, I might have liked men and or women, so what. And I thought that was, I quite liked that. That was quite refreshing to me. It was kind of acknowledging what a mixed up bunch we all are, and so what. I enjoyed that. It felt a little bit like a dig at conservative views, and I couldn't help but think, watching this film, Steve, you know, in the weeks leading up to this, there's been a lot in New Zealand about written about a particular well-known rugby player based in Australia who's a very good player, but who comes from a very fundamentalist Christian background, who's stirred up a huge outcry over his views on gays and how they would all go to hell. And his name was Israel Folau. And this film came out not long after his ultra-conservative views were being discussed on social media and in the mainstream media, and it almost felt like this film was a bit of a one in the eye to him.
And
to
why not? Extent.
And why not?
So, because they did it in a beautifully understated manner as well. It never felt like they were setting out to challenge or attempting to confront. They simply said, well, you know, this is what it is. And I thought that was the understated nature of it is what made it effective. They never gave the impression of trying to make a point. And as a result, the point that they were making got made so much more effectively.
And I mean, there was some, you know, there's some. It's a comedy, right? And although there's a lot of pathos in it, and there are some genuinely funny scenes. There's a sequence that takes place as the two partners and breaker-uppers are forced to maintain the illusion that they really are police officers.
Oh, that scene is horribly painful to watch, but it's very funny.
Yeah, to the point where they have to go to a police station. Oh. I don't want to spoil it any further than that, but I thought that was really funny.
Yes, it was the kind of funny where you find yourself squirming, knowing that they are about to be driven into abject embarrassment and there's nothing they can do about it, and you know it's going to be funny, and they play it very well.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's maybe not a classic film, but I thought it was a well put together film. Yes, it's one idea. The Breaker Upper is its one idea, but I thought the two main actors, and of course they're the writers, pushed it along pretty well. And I, at the end of it, I was thinking. I think, Steve, New Zealanders historically have always had a bit of a cringe factor inbuilt about, oh, are we as good as the rest of the world? Can we do things as well as the Brits and the Americans can, especially with humour, probably.
Yeah.
And I thought, I could imagine an audience in another part of the world sitting down and enjoying this film.
Absolutely. There is one reference to, yeah, we can tell we're Kiwis because.
Yes.
But otherwise, no, it's not a film you have to be a New Zealander to get.
No, I don't think you do. I would happily recommend this. It's not as incisive as perhaps The Death of Stalin was, that we talked about a few weeks ago, but it's a good comedy. You'll laugh and you'll have a bit of a little emotional journey along the road. And yeah, it's a good offering, I think.
It is. I mean, it's insubstantial. It's fairly lightweight, but Van Beek and Sambi, between the two of them, they've got enough going on that they really do find something worth watching in this.
Yeah. And they're good performers. I thought they were both good performers. Held their heads up high. Okay, hey, now, so we're pretty much on song on that one.
Absolutely.
A bit of a Barney. Anyway, let's just stay local if we could for a bit more, Steve. You have been to see another theatrical offering from another multi-talented person, a writer. She's a writer, producer, director, actor. This is Penny Ashton.
Absolutely.
You've seen some of her earlier work. Tell me about this new offering called Olive Copperbottom.
Well, Olive Copperbottom is a sequel of sorts. It's in the same vein as her last one-woman show, Promise and Promiscuity, which was basically a mashup stroke parody of Jane Austen.
Yes, okay.
And so Olive Copperbottom is, unsurprisingly, It is to Charles Dickens what Promise and Promiscuity was to Jane Austen. It's subtitled A Dickensian Tale of Love, Gin and the Pox.
Right. Excellent.
Which almost tells you all you need to know. It's a one-woman show.
Yes.
With probably about a dozen characters in it. And it's profoundly silly. It's very funny. And it's the story of Olive Copperbottom, who is a sort of semi-orphan, you'd have to see the show to understand, in Dickensian London, who is being mistreated the way that only Dickensian orphans can be. And it is played with absolute assured, confident poise by one woman throughout. I mean, she's written this thing, she's produced it, she's completely choreographed and composed it. There's songs, there's audience participation. The whole thing from start to finish is absolutely brilliant. It lasts for about an hour and a half, and you will laugh all the way through it. It is. I don't know how the hell she does it. I really don't. It's a very, very clever idea for a show. And she delivers it fantastic. Like I say, she's about a dozen characters in. And there's never a moment when you find yourself thinking, now, who was that?
Right.
Each character is drawn so sharply. And they're all played by one woman standing on the stage in front of you. It's quite brilliant.
Okay. I have to ask this. And I don't mean to draw a negative inference at all, but so this is, as you say, there's a sort of a companion piece to the earlier production.
Yeah.
And we're drawing on an older writers, famous pieces of literature.
Yeah.
Is there any way in which in the presentation there's any sort of attachment to New Zealand, or is it really of its time, of the writings of Dickens and so forth, that Nostin is?
Oh, she's a Kiwi. Of course she gets references in. I mean,
she does. Okay. The
rest assured, there are Kiwi references all the way through. There's also occasional topical references tossed in as well. She makes it work. She really does. Yeah, so don't worry. New Zealand gets a look in, Simon.
Well, I was at the back of my mind, I was thinking, we're in a time now, in a younger generation now, when some people will just not be so familiar with these people, the authors of these works at all. I mean, of our generation, yes, but maybe less so as time goes on.
Well,
so
I'm going to make a shocking confession now.
Yeah.
I've never actually read a Dickens book in my life.
Well, neither have I.
Well, there you go. And yet I got the gags.
Right.
I mean, just passing references to, that house, it's very bleak, isn't it? Oh, yes, it's a, yeah, it's a very bleak house. Just little things like that. You don't necessarily need to be familiar with the material. In fact, she even explains some of the gags at the end when she's out of character, just doing a bit of a wrap-up at the end of the show. She'll point out of what you may have missed. And there is so much that there are blink and you'll miss it moments. But no, you don't necessarily need a sound grounding. I mean, I'm sure if you were a literature professor, you would possibly get some more out of it. But I remember going to see Shakespeare in Love years ago when it first came out. And I was in California, I was in Berkeley, and I had the English department from the university sitting behind me, and all the way through they went, oh yes, did you get that reference to Sonnet 23? Oh, very good. Oh, jolly good. There's a King Lear reference in there, wasn't there? I mean, you shut up and try and enjoy the film. And sometimes if you're too attached to the content, it can actually detract from your enjoyment of it, because you're so wrapped up in spotting the references. Whereas if you go in as a complete Philistine and ignoramus like I did, you just have a rollicking good time.
Yeah. Hey, so this is like the previous production, is this performed in front of in a relatively small arena?
I saw this at the Amateur Dramatic Hall in Onefero, south of Auckland.
Okay,
and
an audience size of about what would you say? A
couple hundred.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
If we're being generous.
Okay. I just always wonder. You know, you hope that someone who's put so much creativity and energy into a show like this can be rewarded by being able to tour and present the work to as large an audience as possible.
She has taken this overseas challenge as well. She's performed it in Canada and up in Edinburgh. This show is taking her around the world, deservedly so.
Good. Okay, great.
Now, I do want to call back to the last review that we just did as well, The Breaker Upperers.
Yeah,
because there's a line that's worth mentioning in that film where Madeline Sammy's character Mel says to other characters, "I will see you around. This is New Zealand."
Yeah.
And it's a lovely little line. It's a little toss away line.
I really struck with me too. I thought that it was really, really. It's just this one line, but it was nicely written and lovely delivery. Yeah.
Yeah. It didn't feel shoehorned in. It just felt completely organic. And the reality of it really struck me in two ways. One, I don't know if you noticed, you possibly would have a reason to. The character of Jordan, the young lad, when he was playing sports, he was wearing a Papakura High School rugby shirt. And that, of course, is the school I used to teach at. And then at the very end, when there is a scene right at the end of the Breaker Operas where things are going well for couples, there's one couple get married.
Yes.
And the wedding celebrant is Penny Ashton.
Are you kidding?
No, seriously.
Brilliant.
So I'm thinking, you know, that's New Zealand. You know, not only is it true that you will see them around. I mean, you can't go to the pictures without seeing a film with somebody you know in it. It's incredible. And in fact, I tweeted that, and I got a like from Madeline Sammy.
Oh, fantastic!
So it really is. I mean, this is not a country; it's a rather large village.
Yeah, I like the line that she delivered in the film, knowing my proclivities for the music of a certain Mr. Springsteen.
Yes.
There was a Springsteen line in that film as well, which took me by surprise. She talked about images that she gave her happy thoughts or something, and it was a
yes. I remember the line.
Where did it come from? Yes. Anyway, it was interesting. Right. So Penny Ashton tick then, and the Breaker Upper is tick. Now, actually, Steve. Penny's show is a one-woman show. And
yes,
actually,
it was.
Just a few days earlier, there was another one-woman show around the town, was there not? In this case, perhaps one of the most well-known women on the planet. Her name is Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Yes.
And the book she's here to promote is What Happened, a question we're still asking ourselves.
Yes.
In the last election.
Absolutely. Now, Simon, you and I weren't able to make it to see Mrs. Clinton. However, and it's kind of appropriate given where she's from, our guest contributor, Debbie, was there.
Okay, fantastic. And Debbie's with us now. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Simon.
So this was the Hillary Clinton talk at the Spark Arena in Auckland. I'm really interested, not just because, as Steve said, because of your American heritage, to hear what you thought, but just generally, I mean, there's been a lot reported already, Debbie, about the news items, about her comments about the influence of China and so forth. But I'm kind of interested in your having been there and this woman standing in front of you, telling you all this.
Yeah.
How she came across to you? How much of a genuine person did she appear to be, or how much was it really just a performance of material that she was? You know, she'd said it 1,000 times before.
I thought that she sounded very natural and easy to listen to. The time went by very fast. I was amazed at how quickly the time went by. She was funny, personable. It didn't sound like she had rehearsed anything. Obviously, she was well prepared.
Yeah. Mm. And there was quite a bit of reference, obviously, to being in New Zealand and obviously a woman prime minister now. That was interwoven, I think, wasn't it?
Yes. Yep. That was definitely a part of it. It was a part of a talk or part of a series on women in change in politics, changing the world, women changing the world.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, hey, what did. The book is What Happened, and about what happened in that last election.
Mm-hmm.
I've really been interested in, you know, we've heard Obama occasionally interviewed, and he tends not to, you know, really criticize openly Donald Trump. He seems to think maybe that's not being presidential to do that.
Right.
But I'm wondering to what extent or how far did Hillary Clinton go in actually openly criticizing Trump?
She didn't. I don't think that she really criticized him. Probably not as much as one might imagine she could. Let's say she did recount a story about the second of her debates with him, where they did a town hall type debate, And right. she talked about how he was basically behind her, kind of, she used the word stalking her on the stage and gosh. Making faces and just acting really odd. I think she used the word weird. And she said that she really struggled with, should she just keep her cool, stay professional, which is what she did. And she says sometimes when she looks back, she thinks that she probably should have turned around and said, get out of my face, you creep. I think that was her words. And, you know, but she said she could see the headlines the next morning, you know, Clinton loses her cool and, you know, Clinton, you know, can't handle it and, you know, things like that. So she didn't. But now she wonders, you know, that was one of her regrets is that she didn't handle that better. I think that was the only thing that put him in a really bad light, other than the fact that she talked about that presidential campaign as sort of like a reality TV show, kind of a reality TV campaign. But no, she didn't sound, she didn't come across bitter. She obviously was.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she was obviously disappointed, as anyone would be. But I thought she was poised and professional and very engaging.
And was the audience a mix of, how much of a mix of men and women was there in the audience?
It looked like a really good, it looked like a really good mix of men and women to me. I didn't, I didn't pay attention to that too carefully, but I did have a, you know, a decent look around. It looked like, you know, your average sort of middle-class, middle-aged, Kiwis for the most part. That's what it looked like to me.
I mean, one of the criticisms you do hear about, and this perhaps is more about presidents perhaps than presidential candidates, is that after they leave office, they get on this gravy train whereby they move around the world and charging exorbitant fees to speak and maybe not necessarily give you that much. Does this in any way fall into that category for you?
I don't think so. I mean, clearly a lot of these people, and Hillary Clinton would be included in this, are very knowledgeable and have a lot of experience. So for them to, you know, go and give these talks, I think works really well. I thought that she gave value for money. The tickets weren't inexpensive. I got kind of a mid-range ticket for that show. You know, but I thought it was worth it. So I think,
how long did she chat for, roughly?
Let's see. She spoke herself for about a half an hour. And then she spoke with Jenny Shipley for, I'm trying to think. It was a good 45 minutes, maybe longer. I don't remember timing it. But yeah, I mean, I felt like it was a lot of good information.
Okay.
Some things.
Interesting.
That, yeah, some new things for me. Not completely new, but she talked a lot about Russian influence in world politics, and she gave a little more detail than I had really realized. And I did, at the end, get a copy of her book, so I'm looking forward to reading that.
Okay. And I have to ask this. Many people to this day, I suspect, would still in the back of their minds be just wondering how she dealt with the Lewinsky scandal while they were in the White House. Did that get even a passing mention in any way?
No, that wasn't mentioned at all. I think for most people who may be, you know, a fan of Hillary Clinton, I don't think we really think about that anymore at all. That was something that happened so long ago, really. And it had a lot more to do with Bill Clinton than it did with Hillary Clinton, in my opinion. Obviously, it was something that she needed to deal with.
To deal with it,
It was a bit... Yeah. I personally think it was a bit of a personal issue for them, and I think she handled it as well as she decided, you know, the way that she wanted to and as well as she could. So,
And just, you know, one other thought in that you said she wasn't bitter. One of the things that's really struck me, I guess many people, especially in a country like New Zealand where we have our MMP proportional voting system, that of course Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in America by nearly 3 million people.
Right.
Was there any, did that get any sort of mention at all in her analysis of the election?
Yes. She talked about that with regard to the Electoral College and how it really needs to be abolished. She talked about how some states are passing laws where the electoral, I can't remember what they're called, but the people who are voting in that, you know, as Electoral College voters, that they're going to be required by certain states to vote as the population in their state voted. So I don't know all of the details of that myself, but she did bring that up, and it's definitely an issue. I think that it needs to be addressed in a country like America, the way, you know, the way the voting works there, it definitely needs to be addressed.
Fascinating. Okay, so it sounds like you had a pretty good time.
I did enjoy it. Yeah, I wasn't expecting her to be as personable as she was, because she tends to be very professional and very serious. And I think one of the things that she tried to get across that night was that women in politics, particularly in America, I'm less sure, you know, I'm not as sure as much of an issue as it is here, but women have to be a little bit more on their guard. They're judged a lot more harshly for their strength, for their confidence, things like that. So I was expecting her to be just a little bit more professional, but she was actually very personable. So I was pleased with that.
Fascinating. Really fascinating. Okay, thank you so much, Debbie. Great to hear about that evening. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Simon.
Sounds like it was a good show, I was going to say, but I'm not sure that's the right word.
Yeah. Just, you know, Steve, that's really interesting to hear that from Debbie. And just picking up on that last point about, you know, her comments about the possible changing in the electoral system. I mean, I do watch some of those late night American talk shows.
Yeah.
Like Stephen Colbert, for example, on The Late Show, and he talks about Trump just about every day.
Well, yeah.
And I haven't seen every episode he's done, but I don't recall him ever mentioning the idea of changing the way Americans vote, although he often reflects that Clinton won the popular vote. I mean, you've lived in America. Could you ever see this? The Americans... They have to shake up their constitution in quite a big way to change it.
That's the problem. The concept of the Electoral College is in the Constitution, and I was about to say enshrined. And I think possibly that's an interesting point to make, is that Americans do view their constitution as sacred writ, and changing it. Oh, good Lord, no! You can't change it. So that would just be something that makes no sense to most Americans. This is the way it's been done, always has been done, always will be done. It's just that's it. I don't know. Although, having said that, I don't think there has ever been a president as divisive as the one they've got right now. And it's entirely possible that he could be a catalyst for change. Who knows?
Could be. And if you are a country where you think of yourselves as the champion of democracy around the world, and you have an election result which is patently not democratic, as you say, that could be some sort of catalyst. Anyway,
this is entirely appropriate for a entertainment podcast.
Yeah,
isn't
I was gonna
it?
Say, yeah, we can't help ourselves.
I mean, what's that tagline at the start? Anything else that's been entertaining the two of us this week?
Yes.
Yeah, Donald Trump. He's been entertaining us. World's first novelty president.
Yes, not a novelty that many would like to see repeated. However,
well, there is that.
There is that.
Speaking of comedy, and novelty, and entertainment, and people are only good for a laugh. You've been to the comedy festival recently.
Yeah. I've not seen a lot of live comedy. In fact, I haven't seen live comedy for a long time. But I was really pleased to get the opportunity. Sharon and I joined a group of people on a Saturday night to see an event called The Big Show.
Oh yeah,
and it was four very young British stand-up comedians. They were all in their 20s in one evening, and they had about half an hour each, roughly. Their names were Ian Smith, Finn Taylor, Lauren Patterson, and Phil Wang. And
okay.
I've got a review on our website, cravepodcast.com. I'm not even going to try to repeat any jokes, because that's...
that only ever ends in tears, doesn't it? That never goes well.
Yes, it does. But what I thought was... The thing that I really took away from that is, what if you, of all the jobs you could do in entertainment, Steve, God, being a stand-up must be very near the top of in the most difficult of all things to take on. It's just, you're so sort of naked up there. It's just you, a microphone, and a bunch of people, and you've got to, by dint of your personality and your wit, in a matter of seconds, win them over, basically.
It's a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, they all come out and they hit the ground running. They get into things straight away. They know they've got moments to sort of somehow, that something about who they are has to capture this audience, and they then have to hold on to them for the whole half hour or whatever it is. And that most of them did it very successfully in different ways. Two of the four were quite sort of working class northerners. Ian Smith and Lauren Patterson had sort of Newcastle type accents. I guess that's regarded as sort of a good working class area. Would that be fair?
Oh, definitely, yes.
Yeah. So, and it's really interesting. Ian Smith, did the old tried and true, oh, where are you from? And, you know, to people in the audience, oh, where, tell us where you're from. And you think, oh, that's been done 1,000,002 times. But if you can get a little connection going with someone, it works very well. And he had a very laid back, easygoing style of humor, which worked brilliantly. Whereas Lauren Patterson was not telling jokes at all, but was really offering almost psychoanalytical insights into her life and the challenges.
Lordy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds quite heavy, but it was all about the challenges that face a young woman making her way in the world, dealing with issues of her self-image and how she relates to men and maybe in a male-only or male-dominated environment. So I thought Sharon, who was my partner Sharon, she really enjoyed Lauren's analysis very much and thought it was excellent. The other two were more joke tellers. Finn Taylor started really, really well. To me, he slightly lost the audience a little bit in the second half, and it was hard for him to get it back. Whereas Phil Wang is half Chinese and half European.
Yes, I've seen him on I Got News For You. He's quite good, yeah. Isn't he?
He was the funniest and making in a sort of out and out laugh, making you laugh humor. So I just really thought, man, it's, you guys are big ups to you, as they say, because you've just got to, you know, if you do die on stage or it's a lonely, miserable place to come to a cropper if you're not making a connection with the audience. But they did it really well. And I think you as well, Steve, caught up with a comedy act at the festival too. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is quite a different experience in many ways. I saw Andy Zaltzman about a week earlier. Debbie and I went to see him at the Q Theatre in Auckland, and this is a very well established comedian. He's been around for years. He's been doing the Bugle podcast with John Oliver, who's now taking America by storm, And he already had the audience before he even walked out on the stage. And so I think possibly he had a very different experience. I mean, I don't know how he got started. I don't know to what extent he was begging for approval when he first got going. But he's reached the point now where before he even sets foot on the stage, just as the lights go down, he's got the audience where he wants them. He's already won the room over, whereas the guys you're talking about, I get the feeling that they walked out, they basically walk out saying, please like me, and that's got to be hard.
Yeah. And I just want to tell you about when the first chap we heard was a guy called Ian Smith, and he had a little sequence which it just comes back to what you were saying a little earlier about what a small place we live in and what a small world we live in. Would you believe that one of his stories was about going for a holiday to the very place I am now sitting in, the city of Tromsø in Norway. We were about 3 or 4 days from getting on a plane to go to Tromsø in Norway, which is only a town of 75,000 people in the north of Norway. And he told a whole sequence about being on holiday in this town. I just couldn't believe it. I thought, what is the world coming to? It is such a small place.
It is a terrifyingly, terrifyingly small world, isn't it?
Goodness me. Anyway, I think, having seen those guys, I would be of a mind to go and see some more live comedy, because I think there's a certain edge and tension about a live comedy act where you're just thinking, you know, they'll fly or they'll not fly, and there's an energy there I think is really quite addictive in a way, and I can see why people go back all the time to watch that sort of performance.
Oh, most definitely.
Hey, speaking of performances, is there much else on the entertainment horizon in the next week or so that we should be keeping our eyes open for?
A couple of announcements that have been mentioned, and a couple of interesting shows coming up. Probably the biggest show in the next couple of weeks, actually next week, is Imagine Dragons are going to be in Auckland.
Right.
American art rock, who are, I mean, just one of the best shows I've seen in many years. They're going to be in Auckland on the 21st of May. Then they're going down to Wellington on the 23rd. Then we've got Niall Horan, late of One Direction. I don't know if you'll be back in time, Simon. If you're not, contain your disappointment. I know what a One Direction fan you were. He's going to be at Spark Arena in Auckland on June 1st. And
We still have two tickets on offer. The competition closes, if you're listening, guys, before Friday the 18th of June. Get your entries in. Go to the website, cravepodcast.com, when you can be in to win two free tickets to see Niall Horan, late of One Direction, at Spark Arena. Generous. Absolutely. Yes. Now,
I think you put in a... Sorry, where you go?
With regard to new announcements... One of the big names in Australia at the moment is a band called the Jungle Giants.
Yes, I'm just having a quick look on the website about what you've put in there, Steve. Yeah,
yes.
They are they're pretty big over there, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
I haven't heard of them, but that doesn't mean anything.
Well, you're not clearly keeping up with the Brisbane live music scene.
No.
But for those who are, yes. Auckland, Friday, October the 19th at the studio on K Road in Auckland. So that one's going to be pretty impressive. If you're into this kind of thing, and I'll be honest, possibly not completely my tempo, but clearly a lot of people are excited. Pink has announced a fifth Auckland show.
That is a run. That's a run of shows.
At Spark Arena in Auckland, yeah. Bruno Mars, Beyonce, Justin Timberlake, Roger Waters have each played four. Sold out Spark Arena shows. She's adding a fifth on Monday, September the 10th. That's pretty impressive, to be honest.
That is.
And the support act for that is going to be the Rubens, who I saw opening for Imagine Dragons 2 years ago. They're also an awful lot of fun. That could be a good show. But none of those can compete with the big news, which will be, we're recording this on Sunday evening. It'll go out on Monday. Yes. And this information is embargoed until Monday. But since it won't go out until then, I can let you into the secret, Simon. Don't tell tomorrow. Bob Dylan's coming to town.
No.
Yeah, I told you it was a good one, didn't I?
Goodness me!
I know you didn't even realize he was still alive, did you?
When I saw him here, Steve. When was the last time he was here? At least 5 or 6 years ago.
Yep.
And one of my memories of that show was how he started off with his band, and he had a guitar slung around his neck, and it looked like he couldn't support the weight of the guitar.
Oh, lordy, lordy.
And he had to sort of lean over, and then in the end he changed to keyboard. And I just thought, gosh, you know, is he 70 yet? He must be 70.
If he's a day, surely.
Yeah. So I wonder how fit and well he is. I hope he's fit and well, and he's still a. I still listen to Bob Dylan of a day, you know.
Well, you'll be listening to him on the 26th of August.
Oh, okay, that's a very interesting announcement. Okay, thanks.
Spark Arena, and then also, if you feel like getting down to Christchurch, Horncastle Arena on the 28th.
Okay. Wow. Hey, there's one thing I want to mention to you.
What's that now?
Now you may recall another New Zealand comedy that I remember you saw it and you enjoyed it. That was Hunt for the Wilder People.
Oh yes.
It was a Taika Waititi film, and it had Sam Neill was in it, and there was also a very young New Zealand lad called Julian Dennison?
Yes.
Who played the young lad who was on the run. Now he has got himself a role in a big American blockbuster that's about to open in New Zealand.
Go on.
Yes. Deadpool 2.
Seriously?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It's a superhero movie. And apparently the story involves he plays the role of some sort of super talented youngster who Deadpool has to protect. I don't know much about the backstory here. But anyway, I just thought, wow, you've done well for yourself, young man. You've managed to get yourself into a pretty significant Hollywood film there. So,
well, best of luck to him. I mean, Hunt for the Wilder People was all but flawless. So, yeah, he's earned that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd probably go along and see that film just on the basis of seeing how he gets on in the role and how he bounces off all these big-name American performers who'll be around him. So, that'll be interesting.
I really, really enjoyed the first Deadpool film.
It was a hoot, wasn't it?
It was off colour from start to finish, and that was part of the joy of it. And I'd be fascinated to see how your man or your boy dovetails into that, because it could either fail horribly or be the most brilliant thing ever, and I'm hoping it's the latter.
Me too. I think by the time we do our next podcast, that may well have been released, so we might get the chance to have a chat about it next time.
Yeah, anyway, that would be fabulous. Anyway, I'm going to let you get back to your reindeer, Simon.
Thank you so much. Yes. Well, I've got an appointment in an hour, so...
Oh, good man.
I didn't think
you needed an appointment for a reindeer, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. And look, later on this evening, my time, I'm going to be seeing a Norwegian football match, a soccer I'm talking about, in town.
Okay.
I'm going to the local stadium to... I'll try and absorb some of the colour of that. And then next week, on Thursday... It's the 19th, is it? Anyway, no, it's not the 19th. 17th. It's Norway's National Day.
Oh, right.
So our hosts are going to introduce us to some of the events and ceremonies that are associated with that. I've already seen a number of people wandering around the streets here in their national costumes. So that may be something that will be reflected upon next time. So, it should be interesting.
Sounds
good.
In
the meantime, look, if you want to get in touch with us, Steve and I at Crave, we'd be delighted to hear from you. You can email us on podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We're at Crave Podcast.
We are. So until next time, I'm Simon Mercier.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Certainly is.
Lovely. Thank you, Steve.
Well, that was a bit of fun, wasn't it now?